Joe presents TKO, together with 32 Red.
Hello and welcome to TKO and Joe together with 32 Red. We're a podcast and YouTube show with you every Thursday. We are in Manchester this week and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by the WBA Super, the WBC Diamond and the Ring Magazine Super Middleweight World Champion, Callum Smith. Welcome to TKO. Been meaning to get you on for a while. You're now five weeks out from fight week?
Yeah, come to 5 weeks, yeah.
Well, I've just checking the dates. It's the 13th today. And I didn't know if it's five or six. And you're 6 weeks out, that means.
Yeah.
This is the part of camp, I guess, starts to get tough. Yeah. Kind of peak sparring and stuff. You and with Ammo Williams this week. How's everything going?
Yeah, it's going well, to be honest with you. I'm enjoying it. I thought I was fighting September, so I've been in the gym quite a while, like ticking over, which I feel has helped me getting into camp, because normally the first few weeks are tough and you're struggling, you feel like you're behind, whereas I'm feeling good and start to spar. And as you said, start of the week and everything's coming to plan. Obviously, remember the Southpaw this time, so things are a little bit different, but the technical side, I feel I'm getting pretty good.
The first defence at home in front of a Liverpool crowd, your second defence overall, of course, beating Hassan Adam in New York. I bet you remember that first defence, because you fight a lot in your home city when you're building your audience, you're selling tickets, but then to come back as champion, you did it against Chris Avalos after the Keiko Martinez win in Belfast. What's that feeling like?
I think it'll be a special night for you. It seems like you've been out of the ring a long time. Obviously, the last time was the Joshua and Ruiz. And I remember that performance. I was over doing a bit of work for 5'11". Tommy Coyle was on the undercard. But in my opinion, you've beat better fighters. And I remember saying this on 5'11" at the time. I seen that as, if not your best performance, one of your best performances. Just how you went about
the way you did it,
a good fighter. It was kind of overshadowed then by the Joshua loss a bit. But it's great to have you back, but it seems like you've been out for a pretty long time.
Yeah, it's weird. I get a lot of stick saying I was the most inactive fighter and stuff, and some of it was, obviously I had a little girl at the start of the year, so I chose to have a little bit of time out, but then obviously at the level I'm at, it's not as easy sorting fights and getting no respectable opponents, and the damn fight come, and then the plan was to do September, December and get two in towards the end of the year. And again, it was just a nightmare getting an opponent for September, and it was getting closer and closer and closer to the date, to the point where you can't announce a fight with 4 weeks' notice and expect it to sell. So it was, okay, we'll scrap that. We'll just do the one in the November. And like I said, I've been in the gym a while. I haven't been injured, so it's not like I go missing and I go party. And I've always been waiting for the date. It was just getting the right date and the right opponent. And then, obviously, the Mantri was called. So I've got to take care of that. But 2020, I'd say it, same as I said at the last one, I want to be busy, I want to be active, and I want to be in meaningful fights.
The other thing is, I think it's a little bit of a myth when people say you've been out of the ring a long time, because that Super Series, I was looking back over it, because there was talk about it, people saying, oh, he hasn't been here. And actually, you were in camp, I was thinking, at the least, something like 38 out of 52 weeks, the whole of the Super Series. Because, okay, you box, but then you have maybe 2 or 3 weeks, a little bit of downtime, and then you're back in the gym. And at your size at Super Middleweight, you can't afford to be going out and partying and eating what you want. And I do feel, actually, that people have said you had loads of time out. I'm not actually convinced. I agree with that. Because
what was tough about the World Series was I won in my semi-final, and basically the decision was given. Then I'd done it head-to-head with George Groves, so I kind of switched on to George Groves in February, and I didn't box him until September. Yeah, I knew I was fighting him, but it was just getting put back. But mentally, it's hard to switch off knowing you're fighting George Groves for the world title. So I just felt like for 9 months, it was just Gross. Mentally demanding as well as physically kind of thing. Obviously, I had a few weeks off here and there when it was getting postponed, but the whole tournament as a whole was more mentally demanding than physically.
You fought on Carl's undercard as well. Wasn't the second Keiko fight, it was the first Keiko fight.
Yeah, he just told me this, I didn't even remember.
Yeah, it's one of the best atmospheres I've been at. It was good, I stayed for the main event, and it was a good fight, to be fair. It was a good win.
The first Keiko fight?
First one, European title.
I remember there was an incident happened.
Yeah, at little the ball. Little yeah, ball, the cameraman. Ball. They had a little push at the weigh-in. So all the cameras ran to get it. And a camera clipped my little nephew on the head. I think he was only about 4 at the time.
It cut him and stuff,
didn't it? Yeah, there was all blood coming off it. So there was a bit of come up, Paul.
I remember it. I remember saying sitting at ringside in my interview after, I hope Paul Smith's kids are all right. Because I remember it happening and I felt bad. But it was like the cameraman, he knew he'd done it.
Yeah.
He just continued to do what he was doing.
Filming, and that's what Paul was like. He didn't even turn around to acknowledge it kind of thing. So there's a bit of... But yeah, no, it was a good fight. It was a good experience.
And of the four of the brothers, I feel like, I mean, obviously this will be down to you, but I feel like Paul's probably the most hot-headed out of the four of you. Is that fair?
No, Liam. Liam, is he? 100%.
He mentioned this to me yesterday, and I says, I would say Liam.
Yeah, Liam. Liam, most argumentative. And Liam and Paul. Paul might be second, because Liam and Paul clash a lot of the times over stuff like that.
Do they still clash? Opinion.
Yeah, not serious, but they always just got an opinion and they're both right, no matter what kind of thing. Liam's the most hot-headed, 100%.
Is he? Okay. Yeah. So six of you grew up in the household, four brothers, two sisters. Mm-hmm. I mean, tell me about these days growing up. So what's the order of ages?
Paul, Stephen, Liam, me, and then the two girls, Chloe, Holly.
Okay, yeah. So you're the youngest of the boys and then older than the girls. Yeah. So talk to me about the household dynamic with eight of you.
Yeah, it was good, busy, and I say to my missus now, I love being in a big family. I couldn't think of anything different. I couldn't imagine being an only child or having just one or two siblings, and I wouldn't mind if she gave me six, but I think she'd probably give me one more. But I've always known it, a busy house. Even now you go to my mum's and there's always someone in the house. It's always busy, and that's always what I've been brought up around. And you think being in that environment, I'd be quite outgoing and I'm quite quiet, but it's just around my family, I'm comfortable and we are a close-knit family.
Yeah. I guess you have to be quite self-sufficient as well from a pretty young age, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. You know, one of six, I was hardly spoiled as a kid, do you know what I mean? We grew up on your normal working class council estate, but I had a very, very good childhood, and I say I wouldn't change it for the world, and we're still as close now as we was growing up.
Okay. Talk to me a little bit about your brothers, because obviously Paul is now retired, the other three of you are active. Yeah. A lot of the guys, when pushed, they always say, you're the most talented of the four. Where do you see yourself fitting into the pack?
I don't know, it's hard, because I think at the start they used to say, oh yeah, Callum's the best, when I probably weren't. They probably just felt sorry for me, because I was the youngest, and probably just had to big me up a little bit, because they were always winning stuff and I was still coming through. But I think we're all good in different ways, and I've gone through my whole life looking up to my three brothers, who they were. I put them on a massive pedestal and I've always wanted to be like them. So it's hard for me to sit and say, oh yeah, I'm the best of the four of us, because I still don't believe I am. So I learn a lot off the three of them, and I think I've got to thank them a lot for the position I'm in now. I've learned off all of them come through my career. And
all different types of fighters too.
Yeah, we're all very similar. Like, we've got similar things, but we're all so different as well. But
physically, you're all very different as well.
Yeah, if you've seen just me and Stephen, you wouldn't think we were brothers. But if you see the four of us, we kind of connect each other. But people used to always ask me, do you feel pressure being the youngest of the four? And I've always felt the opposite. I've always felt like I went to Paul's debut, 2003, and I've been around professional boxing since then. I think I was only 13 at the time. So I've always felt I've got like an old head on young shoulders because of that.
This year we've seen Anthony Joshua and Luke Campbell in high-profile losses. I think arguably you're our most successful and our strongest world champion. I would say most people would agree with that.
I would, yeah.
Maybe if you had a world title, you wouldn't, but no. We'll get one next year. But you were due to go to the Olympics in 2012, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I certainly feel you were kind of shafted out of that. Just talk to me about what happened in the build-up to that, because, of course, 2012 was such a huge launchpad for certainly four or five fighters from the UK, and you really were denied your opportunity at the qualifiers.
Yeah, it was... No, I got on a GB team, and Everton, you probably know the same, being on the aisle. Everton's like 4-year cycles to the Olympics, no matter what year you're at, it's always build up to the next Olympics. And I was on there, I think it was 3 years before London, and every training session, every tournament you went to was London, London, London. I think it was a bit more made a fuss of because it was a home Olympics as well, and to have, not brainwashed, but have it drilled in, London, 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 and then to get it took away at the last minute. And then I had to watch everyone else go. And it was more, I'd always envisioned going to the Olympics, becoming an Olympian, turning pro, and getting that little bit of a springboard, a little bit of a early push. And I think we've seen now it doesn't guarantee your success in the pros. You've still got to get on and do it, but it does help at the start. And then all of a sudden I'm sitting there thinking, what do I do now? Do I go pro, but kind of go under the radar kind of thing? And at the time it was Everton. It was like my whole career, it just smashed into pieces. Whereas looking back now, it probably wasn't as vital as I thought it was, even though if I could go back in time, I still wish I was an Olympian. It's an unbelievable achievement, and one that I feel I should have been there. You know, I had to watch the lad who beat me go to the Olympics, and it went the worst decision in the world, but I definitely feel I won the fight.
That was a bad decision.
Yeah, it was a bad decision. Because it was the Azerbaijani that you were given the decision against in the semi-finals that would have secured your place. Yeah. We'll come on to, because we were talking earlier, funnily enough, about what happened to Mick Conlon and some of the stuff at the Rio Olympics that has been reported. But at the time, were you aware he was an Azerbaijani fighter? Were you aware of the politics and the financial corruption that was going on behind the scenes? Was there any talk about it at all amongst the team?
No, to be honest with you, and I've had bad decisions before and there's been millions since me and you're just one of many and you kind of just get on with it, but you never think, you never go into the ring thinking they're going to shaft me. You'd always believe if I win the fight they'll give me it, and especially at that level you think they won't take this away from me. And I think it was the second round, they had a big second round, I sat down, I was level going into it, and then I heard like weird, like, cause the scores come up and I heard like a weird like cheer and I thought, was that for me or him? And I was down going into the last round and I remember just thinking, wow, I'd give everything that round, thinking I've got a lead and I can just get on my bike. And I was down, and I think it was then I knew. So even when the bell went, I kind of knew I'd lost, if that makes sense. But it's one of them, like I said, there's been more bad decisions since me. It was just the time it happened to me was so vital in my career. Yeah. And it was the difference between going to the Olympics and not going to the Olympics, which was hard. And there was still a chance for me to qualify the next day, because the third place.
Yeah, to catch you waiting.
I'd rather have had a box off with the other losing semis, and it went. And then the two people got in, and it was the take against the thing going. It was like, I've watched better sparring sessions. They were just like touching each other and that.
The context of this, of course, was for those people that don't know, is that there was a payment made from an Azerbaijani firm to AIBA of $10 million that $4.5 million of which was unaccounted for. So PricewaterhouseCooper did an independent investigation. Mm. Almost half the money went missing. And the correlation between that and Azerbaijan, I think they won 11 medals at the subsequent three championships, including 5 golds. And when you compare that to the previous 37 years, they've won 4 medals in total and no golds.
Yeah.
So we were talking on the phone earlier about this article in the Irish Times about a year or so ago. Joe Hennigan, who was part of the Irish, I think he was the Irish team manager for the Rio Olympics, he was given information by Zao Antia, who I believe you know.
Zao, he's the Irish head coach, yeah.
Right, and he, for whatever means, had a conversation with a Russian coach who had said that the medals were all fixed and that they knew the outcome of Mick Conlon's tournament. And obviously, imagine having that information when you're in the middle of an Olympic Games. You of course, can't pull your fighter out because then he's guaranteed to not get a medal. But at the same time, you're going into something that you have no clue whether it's fixed or not. You're hearing rumours, you're hearing speculation. Yeah. And then something happens, as it did with Mick and Vladimir Nikitin. And I mean, it causes waves and it causes talk, but ultimately, as we'll come on to in just a moment with a GB fighter at the Women's Worlds last week, no change is actually made.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's it. It's like, I don't think anything's ever going to be done about them, because you give it 2 weeks and it's completely forgot about. You're into a new tournament, new multinations, and there's probably another robbery. And I think that's why nothing's ever going to change, because they just get forgot about.
And we talk about Karis Artingstall, who was boxing in the semi-final of the Worlds last week, and I've sent the fight to you guys to have a look at. Yeah. The Russian was already through to the final. Karis had boxed that 3 or 4 months ago, beat her 5-0 with 2 standing counts. They knew full well that were she to make it through to the final, there would have only been one outcome, and that would have been a gold for Great Britain, barring, you know, the things that can happen in boxing. Yeah. But she looked a very strong favourite for that. Yeah. Talk me through what you saw of her semi-final.
I watched it last night. Obviously, you sent me it through, and I thought she boxed well the first time I've seen her. She knows a good southpaw, and I thought she just kind of controlled the fight just at distance and didn't really let the little girl get in range and stuff. And I thought she won it comfortable, to be honest with you. And I think the reactions of the two of them at the decision at the end kind of showed who the winner was in the fight.
Even the reactions from the corners, like, Karis looked, her corner, was it Lee Poulin?
Lee Poulin was
the head trainer in her corner, and they just looked happy as if she'd won the fight.
Yeah.
I watched the fight again because you sent me it, and she won the first round well. She won the second round even more convincingly in the first round. I kind of skipped through the third, and it was a round that, but sort of skipped through, she still won as well. But you look at the reactions at the end, and you know enough about it, and it's just like, it's hard to see. You know, you don't like to see it, and there's people, they're messing with people's emotions and everything here. It's not just about the result of a fight and you go away and you forget about it. You don't. People are putting a lot of effort into winning big medals and representing their country. And it just, honestly, amateur boxing, and it has for a long, long time, but it just doesn't seem to be getting any better. It's ridiculous.
Because, of course, you did actually get the contract with Matchroom out of after 2012, yeah. where you didn't have that Olympic pedigree as such.
Yeah.
But I guess the ramifications for you at the time financially would have been significant because you wouldn't have a medal or Olympic exposure to bargain with.
Yeah, like I could probably guarantee you the Olympians who turned over a few months after me got paid more for the debut than I did. And even just like publicity and sponsorship and stuff, they probably got more than what I got. Like I said at the time, I don't think that'll define my career. I still believe I'll get to where I want to be. And thankfully I have so far. And obviously it's flipped, but at the time, it'll just be a nice start to your pro career where money isn't the best when you're starting off, and especially if you want to do it full time and you're doing four rounds. If you're an Olympian, it's definitely a lot easier.
Yeah, I suppose the flip side of the coin is that you're able to build under the radar without the spotlight, because the Olympians have, it seems like, an infinite amount of pressure on them compared to everybody else. Everyone's looking at Josh Kelly and Boazzi and Okoli, and if they put a foot wrong, people are very quick to jump on them. So you can build in a way, sort of in a quiet way. But I feel like your career got to a point where people wanted to see you let off the leash. You proved yourself at British level. You won so comfortably against Rocky Fielding that I think people were then calling out for you to make this step up. And the Super Series came at the sort of perfect point, it feels like, in your career. Is that how it felt to you?
Yeah, it did, because it kind of took me away from a terrible negotiation thing with the WBC. I was mandatory to fight Anthony Drell for the vacant belt, and they won the purse bids, and then it was like they didn't want to put the fight on. They was getting told May, then, oh no, it's going to be June, then it's going to be September. And I remember I signed a contract for LA, September the 9th, so I thought, happy days, it's done. I started training, and then he said, oh no, it's not going to be that date, it's going to be later on. In Flint, Michigan. I was like, I've signed a contract for LA. So then there was all that. And then at the same time, the World Series Boxing was getting offered to me, but it sounded too good to be true, to be honest with you. They were just telling me all these top fighters going to be world titles in it. And then the money was really good for what other fighters were in at that time. And I just thought, there's got to be some form of catch. And then the longer the negotiations went on with Darrell, I just thought, let's do it. Let's just scrap them. So I gave up a world title shot to go into a tournament where I knew Groves was C1 and I was going to be C2, so I knew I'd have to win two fights to guarantee me a world title shot, but I was confident in my own ability. I knew I was good enough to do it. It was the longer way of doing it, but it worked out best for me.
Yeah, it's actually a good point about the Super Series. It's not been flawless. There have been a few things with financial payments being late and stuff, but actually, given the ambition of the setup itself, it's been remarkably good, hasn't it?
No, it has been. It's a great format, and it's putting, they're trying their best to get the top guys. I think it was a great success when Callum won his. I think the bantamweight one at the minute with Inouye and Dener is going to be a special final. Taylor and Progray again. The cruiserweights at the same time as you was quality. So there has been a few complaints from fighters and different people, but in terms of producing the fights, so far so good. It's been a really exciting format for me, and I hope, there's been rumours that maybe this is going to be the last year. It may not continue, I'm not sure, but I hope that it keeps continuing. And we are seeing most of the best in each division fighting each other.
Hasn't happened for a long time, has it? And they talked about, you know, the fact that boxing lacks a centralised governing body, that sometimes the way forward might be to put these kind of semi-permanent tournaments on so that promoters can invest in a tournament rather than feeling like they've got to deal directly with each other. Yeah. And if the money's right, that's always the fundamental thing with a big fight, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. And that's, you know, it's again, it's the old money talks in this game. It's a wee bit of a cliche. Well, it's a big bit of a cliche, but it does. And people have to, if you're going to fight someone, you can listen to boxers all day. I'll fight him for free. I'll do this for free. They won't. It just doesn't happen. It's a tough sport where you deserve to be well paid, especially if you're fighting the top contenders. And the Super Series at the minute seems to be producing that and producing the money that's making people come to the table and sit down and negotiate. Whereas fights, without the Super Series, I don't know, the Groves and Callum Smith fight may never have happened, I don't know.
Yeah.
And you were talking about the Darrell fight, that it was hard to get made. Yeah. And in the end, you come out the other side of the Super Series and you're the number one in the division.
Okay, we'll be back with Callum Smith in just a few moments' time. Right now, though, here's John Amici with something new from Joe.
My day job is helping businesses thrive through disruption. This show is not about business. It's about people who go from nothing, a seed of an idea, something that everybody thinks is completely impossible, and build it into this massive,
massive, massive
business. There are 1,000 different ways to be a huge success. One of the most interesting things that we're learning is that how people are failing is almost as important as how they succeed. In fact, it's integral. It's business. Pioneers is having really honest conversations with people, talking about their business, their objectives, their purpose, whether they're just out to make a ton of money and then quit, or whether they really want to change the world. Pioneers on Joe. Listen to it. Download it. Watch it. I had nothing profound to say.
We were talking to Big Stephen Ward last week because he's in the MTK Golden Contract to light heavyweight, and he won't know who his opponent is until fight week. Now, there are no seeds, so it's kind of if you get picked out of the draw, you get to choose. If you don't, you might get chosen. You, of course, were, I think, one of the seeds. You got to choose.
Two.
So you picked Skoglund first, right? So did you speak to Joe before that, saying, look, who are we going to go for if we get the option?
A little bit, but it was just in day-to-day life. I hate making decisions. I always hear reassuring off people, and I was phoning my brothers, and like my brothers are like my biggest fans. Like, they rate me more than probably anyone, and I was saying, you should have picked out the four, and you're saying, you'll beat all four, just pick whoever you want. And I was thinking, just let me know someone. And then Joe was studying and watching them, and then it was more, I needed to have kind of two picks because I had no idea who Groves was going to pick. So it was just Groves picked Jamie Cox, and then I went up, and the fight, looking back now, I think Skoglund was probably the best out of four non-seeds. But I had three fights before the tournament when I was waiting for a world title shot, and I'd got into a habit of just basically walking after people, trying to knock them out and load them up. And I feel I'd lost my boxing ability, and I was just getting frustrated when I was going into round five and six, thinking, how haven't I got rid of him yet? And I just felt the Skoglund one was tall, had a good jab, and I thought, if there's anyone to get me back boxing and thinking before I go into range, it'll be him. So it wasn't I picked him thinking it was easy fight, because I knew it was a tough one, but I knew it would benefit me in the long run, and I picked him, and it ends up a tougher fight than I expected, but I still think it was the right move for me.
Yeah, and then of course you had the younger Bremer pull out after that, and Nicky Holsken kind of stepped in. How many days before the fight was that?
It was the Monday. I was about to walk on the plane to Germany, and I think it was as we both switched the phones off, Sean, who's outside there, then got a phone call, but he said Bremer's out. So then I had to sit on the plane thinking, you're fucking going to fight.
Yeah.
And it was like, and then for the next few days, they were throwing all different names in. And then I think he was on the undercard anyway, so they put him in. And I remember watching him thinking, he's terrible. And then Joe was telling me to keep watching him, saying, Joe, I can't, because the more I watch him, the more I'm going to be complacent kind of thing. And to be fair to him, he was tough. He took a few good shots, and he was physically strong himself. But I enjoyed that fight the least out of any fight I've ever wanted, because the minute I was in there, I just wanted the belt to go and finish it. So I was in the final fighting Groves. It was more, I had so much to lose and not really much to gain. People were saying, oh, he's a kickboxer, to be gone in two rounds. And he was tough. I did hit him early on, and he kind of bounced off him. And I just didn't want to be known as the fella who just blew his world title shot by losing to a kickboxer. And it was just so much pressure on that fight than any other fight I've ever had in my life. And when the girls walking around with the numbers, I was just thinking, just put number 12 up and we can get this done with now, kind of thing. And so it wasn't the best performance, but I always knew I'd deliver when it mattered.
I feel like late standbys can be the biggest banana skins in boxing. You know, with Joshua and Takam, that was a late replacement. Mm-hmm. He had to box very cautiously against him. And then, of course, Ruiz, the ultimate example of that in recent times. Mm-hmm. Actually, quite a testament to someone like Callum who can make that adjustment, because you boxed in a very safe and controlled manner. There was no low-risk strategy.
I said, like, obviously I was getting texts in a fight week for tickets for me and Groves, because Groves had beat Eubank the week before. I was thinking, wow, like, everyone else is looking past them. I was thinking, imagine I slip up, like, it should be the worst case scenario in the world. I'd be a 60-year-old man thinking, wow, you had the chance to go fight George Groves and in, like, whatever. And you slipped up by losing to a kickboxer. So it was just all pressure on me. So I just remember just thinking, just box, nothing silly, no injuries, no cuts, and win, and then I'll go and do an amateur kind of thing, whereas that performance wouldn't have beat Groves, but I knew it was enough to beat him.
Out of order to be sending text messages looking Groves.
Yeah, I was getting loads of messages and I was saying, hey, don't forget, keep me tickets for you and Groves, and I was looking at them on Instagram and that, and I felt like just
replying. Yeah, cheers, lads, yeah.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, wow, like, everyone was just assuming it was a one-round blow kind of thing. Yeah. And it just, I'd say the pressure was just more in that fight than any of the other fights.
The amateur background that you've had has probably suited you well in that situation, because you know, it does happen. We've seen it happen where late standbys come in, Reece as well, with Joshua. What was it, 5 weeks? Six weeks?
Yeah, something like that.
Late enough, but yours was literally...
Monday. I'd done everything. I'd done my whole... I'd done sparring partners over from Europe, Southport. I'd done my whole camp, and then took me long. It's better to go from an autox than a Southport standing. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's not as tough, but it was just tactically, I didn't know much about him. I put a video of him, and it was in like a boxing gym. It was like a show in a boxing gym, and I was doing really footage I could get of him. So it was just like the amateurs where you just get in and see how it goes. And like I say, I got the win, I got the job done and moved on, but it was safety first kind of performance.
I suppose the one benefit of the tournament is having those paid standbys and having people that they know are on the books, even if they're on the undercard, that they can move up even at the last minute. And that's a sensible contingency. It's one of the things that dragged the Super 6 out a little bit longer than it probably should have. And I think that's a good, obviously a lesson learned by Callis Owland and the guys put it together. But again, even in your situation, Tyler McCreary is not a name that many people will know. He's got 16-0. People are going to, you know, underestimate him and just assume that you've got to go and win, but you're the one that has to go and do it.
That's a different sort of pressure when you're just expected to blow someone away as well. And you know, he's had long enough. I think he was meant to fight someone else and they've pulled him off the bill, so he's been training. So it's not as if he's just had 6 weeks' notice and he's starting to get ready for a fight. So he'll be in good shape, but he's a tall, kind of slick American. Not a bad fighter at all, but because he's not really known, people are expecting you just to go in and blow him away. And that's when you have to be able to, you know, me, myself, I have to be mentally strong enough not to pay too much attention to that. And if it's going, you know, if it's 6, 7, 8 rounds and people are starting to make noises around ringside saying, why has he not got rid of him yet? I just need to keep focused and make sure I get the job done.
That's what I've learned to do recently over like the last couple of years. As I said before, like I boxed Luke Blackledge and it was getting like round, I'd drop him and then the bell would go and then it'd start again the next round and I'd drop him again and the bell would go. And then it was round 7, 8, 9 and I remember just thinking, I'm going to get slated for this and everyone's bored and mentally it just beat me up myself and then actually knocked him out with a very good shot. But I was just walking the corner and said to Joe, it was about 7 rounds too late. It's just the pressure of everyone else got to me. Whereas now I just think, if I win, I win. As long as I'm boxing well and I've got it in my own head, then I don't care what anyone else thinks. But coming through, I felt that pressure massively, as in everyone just assumed I'd win early. And when I didn't, I started to get frustrated with myself.
I fought a guy called Chris Hughes for a Commonwealth title in York Hall. I was beating him up pretty good. I ended up knocking him out, and it was a good knockout in the 8th round or something. But I remember being criticised by Jim Watt ringside, saying, you know, he needs to get rid of him here. But I was really, like, breaking him down. And I remember listening to what he said, and it kind of affected how I fought after that. And it shouldn't have. I should have just continued to fight how I liked to fight and make sure I get the win. The win's almost the most important thing. But I was trying to be a bit more exciting in my fights because Jim Watt give me stick on Sky.
Was that? Could you hear him whilst you were fighting?
No, this was after.
Right.
But that's, it's really, it's a little bit childish of me, like,
well, no,
changing how I fight because of Jim Watt. You know what I mean? One man.
I guess. But then at the same time, you also have to listen to your public. I mean, I don't know. Did you watch Bivol at the weekend?
Yeah.
He's somebody that is very, very good at what he does. He's obviously very, very difficult to beat. But with that kind of one-paced nature, doesn't really go through the gears. I kind of feel like every fight I've ever watched of his, once you've seen one round, you've kind of seen all of them. Yeah. Unless he lands that very crisp shot and takes somebody out, which he has got the capability of doing. Yeah. But it's quite a risk-averse style. It's almost like he boxes like you did against Nicky Holsken, but against everybody.
Yeah.
And you can hang on to your belts that way, but at some point, you have to wonder whether he's going to drift into that, like, who needs him club, because he doesn't do huge tickets. He's a very difficult guy to beat, but also people are going to be looking, going, well, why would I take him on when there are more exciting fighters who sell more tickets? You do have to listen to your public, I suppose.
Yeah, you do, just not Jim Watt.
I guess the benefit, of course, you knew that the Groves fight was there, provided you got the win. But in the real world, if you have a performance that people perceive as being a bit flat or they see weaknesses, that does open those doors against other fighters, as you well know.
Yeah.
If you have those fights and people see that and they go, actually, do you know what? I fancy Frampton or I fancy Smith.
I think it happened. Prime example. We've talked about it on the show before. Yeah. Is when I got dropped in El Paso by Alejandro Gonzalez.
Got dropped twice.
Got dropped twice in the first round. Thanks for bringing that up. And the same night, Scott Quigg fought Kiko Martinez and blew him away.
Yeah.
And I fought Kiko twice. I knocked him out once. The second time, I beat him in points. But I beat him, I think, the second fight was more convincing than the first knockout, because up until I knocked him out, it was pretty close.
Yeah.
But me and Quigg have been talking for a long time about fighting, and the fight just never looked like it was going to happen. And then I think that they seen, Scott and Joe and maybe Eddie, they seen, you know, me getting dropped, put over twice by this big skinny kid who's no one's ever heard of. Let's take the fight now. And it was a blessing in disguise for me, because the fight happened, I won the fight. And then Leo Santa Cruz fight, I think, even came off the back of that, because I was mandatory for him when I was a super bantamweight for the WBC title. And that fight never happened. And I think them two big fights, the two biggest wins of my career, came off the back of me being put down. Yeah. Mm.
Interesting, isn't it? And I suppose once you get to the top of your career, it then becomes a totally different ball game. It's negotiating your way into the biggest fights and securing the biggest paydays, because I always see that as like, it's backdated money for all the years that you probably boxed in the amateurs unpaid, and you fought for low purses in the early stages of your career. Those big money purses are what make it all worth it. And you've been in that situation, and you're currently at the top of your game. You are now you've just arrived at the peak, really. And the options for you seem almost endless, but at the same time, it's very difficult getting the negotiations over the line for some of these. And I know you get names thrown at you all the time. The lay of the land at the moment, you've got Benavidez, Caleb Plant, Billy Joe, and yourself and Billy Joe with Matchroom, Benavidez and Plant kind of on the PBC side of things with Fox, and the two don't really work together.
Yeah.
So it means, in terms of the super middleweights, your options really at the moment limited to Billy Joe Saunders, but you're looking at mega fights at this stage, right?
Yeah.
So talk to me.
Yeah, obviously there's three other champions in my weight division. There's four belts and we're all unbeaten. Mm. So I think that's quite rare, and it should be exciting. Should we all fight? You obviously mentioned why some of them might happen, but I'd jump at any of them fights. I want unification fights. I've ticked the box of being a world champion. No one can take that away from me. Now it's to see what more I can achieve. And I remember getting to the top and thinking the world title was the pinnacle, and when I got it, I thought, nah, I've got more, there's more I can do. And that's what I'm in boxing for. And there's a mega fight out there, say Golovkin, Canelo, their names that I jump at the drop of an hat. I'm in a good division with a lot of big fights. It's just, I wish it was a little bit more simple to make them all. I feel now it's harder to make fights than it was when I was coming through. And you think when you get to world title, you'd have them all queuing up to fight you. And as I found out trying to fight in September, it's not as straightforward as people would like to think. And that's the downside of boxing. People don't really see. You have people saying, when are you going to fight him? Why don't you fight him? And I don't think many boxers are scared of facing each other. It's just the team and all the other stuff that gets involved with it, which kind of stalls or stops fights happening.
We spoke about this beforehand. I think, obviously, anyone in their own weight divisions, the Canelo fight is the one you want, because it's humongous money.
Yeah.
And it brings a lot of publicity and everything. But there was talk of you and Canelo at Anfield and stuff. I've seen that. But I don't know how you feel about this, but I just don't think that fight happens. And the reason being is I think they're a very shrewd team. Mm. They've got Kovalev at the right time.
Yeah.
I think you're just all wrong for Canelo. Too big for him.
I'm not saying he's scared to fight me and all that, but I just think he's Canelo. He can fight whoever he wants.
Yeah.
I don't know why he can't pick 6'3" champion at the weight above. And I think if it was to happen, it'd have to be massive demand for it. Like if I was to go and beat some of the other champions, or they'd probably wait until I look like I'm dead of the weight and about to move up, and then he'd try and get me kind of. Then I think they are smart kind of thing. He's a special fighter. He's probably top 3 pound for pound. I don't put myself top 3 pound for pound, but I believe there's weight divisions for a reason. Yeah. I think he's a better middleweight.
I guess that's the other thing that we have to address, is the size of you at super middleweight. It never ceases to amaze me. And I was saying to the guys before you come in, I said, wait till he walks through the door, and then just bear in mind he boxes at 74 and a bit kilos. There is going to come a point where you will have to move up. And I feel like once you do and you let your body expand, it will probably be impossible for you to go back down. So you have to get the work done at super
middleweight.
Yeah,
that's what I've always said. I said, like, I'm not in that position where I can move up and come back down or swap and change weights. No, I'm not dead at the weight, but it's getting harder. I'm getting bigger and bigger, and I think once I move up, that's it. I'll stay at light heavy, and I just don't want to close the chapter on 168 just yet. I do feel there's more to achieve before moving up, but if the right offer got offered at 175, I would move up, but I just think there's a little bit more I can achieve while I'm still doing the weight and still performing at it.
Never fights at 168, like Benavidez and Plant, although they're not as, obviously not as big a name as Canelo or Golovkin, they are quality fighters.
Yeah, they are the very good fighters, to be fair, and I do rate the two of them. They both got belts, which you know I do want, and they are big fighters, though they haven't got the profile, as you said, like as your Canelo or your Golovkins, but it doesn't mean the easier fights, they are two very good fighters.
Yeah. Mm. There's options all over for you. It's just, it's negotiating that right path, as you say, for the right money.
Yeah.
It does feel like there's been a lot of chess positioning by the various promoters at super middleweight. I guess probably in anticipation of Canelo making the step up longer term at some point. You were approached by, I don't know which promoter, no, obviously it's completely up to you if you don't want to say, but you had a couple of offers like a couple of months ago?
Yeah, I had a few offers, a few promotional offers, and I say I've always been happy with Matchroom. He's done a good job with me, but it's nice to get other people interested in you, and they'll tell you the plans for you and tell you how much they rate you and stuff like that, and I know they tell you what you wanted to hear, but it was nice, and like I say, some of them had other fighters which were good fights for me, and it kind of probably made Eddie sit up and say, well, I can do this for you, and I didn't use it as that kind of thing, but it worked out better for me, and the plan Eddie's got for me is a good one, and one that I'm happy. And I say, like, boxing's a selfish sport. I do get loyalty, but I've got a short career. I've got to do what's best for me, and at the minute, best for me is that match doing where I am now. And I say we get this fight out the way and hopefully push on into 2020, but I'll always do what's best for me in my career. And it's nice to have options rather than feel like you've already got the one.
Were those contracts with that contract with Matchroom, sorry, was that coming to an end? Was that why you got the offers in? Or
It's a bit of a tricky one because I've never actually had a long-term contract with them. It's always just been, we'll do this fight, next fight, and then just
and
negotiate.
So long,
yeah, and I'm at the position now where each fight kind of negotiable kind of thing, but now he's come and said his plan for this one, and then hopefully a big fight in May, and then push on from there. So it was more just I needed to know what his plan was for me and what route, and you know, we had a good meeting and we sat down, and I say I've never fell out with them. I've always had a good relationship with them, and they've been very good for my career from the debut till now. It was just, you know, the offers come in, I looked at them, but I went with the one that was best for me.
Because obviously Benavidez got his belt back from the rail, his mandatory yield rooms failed test, so he's kind of freed up. I know Eddie's kind of lobbying for that fight. What would be your ultimate preference if you could design the perfect fight at the perfect venue? Go.
Anfield is the one I would want to do. Now, I said I want to do New York, Madison Square Garden. I've done. I'd like to do Vegas, which Carl's done. I'd like to do Anfield. They're the three.
I got beaten Vegas, well.
Still done it.
Still did it though, yeah. So you'll get to have a win in Vegas.
They're the three. Like venues I'd like to tip off. I've done one of them, so Anfield would be special, and it would need a big opponent in the opposite corner. You know, I'm not going to sell thousands and thousands against a no one, so it's hard to pick one. Obviously, I'd pick one Canelo. The chance of it happening are very slim. I think Golovkin's a great fight for me. I said it before, his last fight, even though he didn't look the best, but he's a good fighter, and he's someone I've been a massive fan of over the years. I just think he is slightly getting over it, and again, he's a better middleweight. If he was to move up, I do think I'd beat him. The three champions, they're all very, very good fighters. But like, I watched Benavidez beat Darrell, and I think I beat him. So I think I beat him. Like, give me the chance to do it and prove it. If I don't, then fair enough. But I believe I've got the beating of all the three champions. So why not go for it?
No, I agree with you. Who would you like to see him fight?
Well, I'd love to see the Canelo fight because I think he's the superstar of boxing, the number one guy in world boxing at the minute. And I think, not just saying it because you're sitting here beside me, but I think you beat him. So, and that's why I don't think the fight happens. But I think the Golovkin fight could be made. And either
he's a
or.
Massive name, in Golovkin.
Either they sell out Anfield twice over, like it would be insane. I would definitely be there. So one of them two. I can see the Golovkin fight.
I think if he doesn't get Canelo,
he's
left them with no options. So he'll have to look elsewhere. Which hopefully, I'm in the act for it. But I think a lot just depends on whether Canelo gives him the third fight or not.
You mentioned Madison Square Garden. It was a memorable night for a number of reasons. You know, you made quick work of Ndam, but actually was on the card. Katie Taylor in that absolutely unbelievable fight against Delphine Bassoon, and then Joshua, where were you sitting for the final?
To be honest with you, the first round, I was filling my forms for my drug test, and it was on the screen.
Oh,
and I remember the drug testers saying, oh, I think this will be over quicker than yours. I'd love to go and see them after it, to be fair. I think everyone just thought it was going to be a quick blowout, and then I ran out and I ran into the venue to see where my brothers was, and as I went in, I seen the first knockdown, so I just stood and watched it.
Oh, Ruiz go down?
Yeah, I seen Ruiz go down, and I couldn't find one of my brothers, and they were watching it in my changing room on the telly. So then I ran back in my changing room, sat with them and watched it on the telly. Weirdly enough, I was in the venue and watched it on the TV, but it was just, it wasn't the biggest upset in boxing, but it's probably the biggest one I've seen. I've been there, Aaron. It was just so many people ripped Ruiz off, even though I said beforehand he can fight, but then when I see him at the public workout, he was too small in my opinion. I thought, nah, you're tiny, you're shorter than me. I thought, as much as you are better than what people are giving you credit for, I do think you are too small, but listen, he proved me wrong, he proved a lot of people wrong.
Bizarre atmosphere after that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was strange. Yeah. A bit surreal. I remember, you're talking about him being smaller than you. I remember he got into the lift beside Stephen Ward, who's probably an inch smaller than you again. And Stephen Ward looked a lot taller on him.
Yeah.
And that's the reason, I was saying to people to see him, Ruiz can fight, he's a good fighter, but it looked comical, almost the weigh-in and stuff, you know what I mean? It looked like a sketch show. It didn't look.
I think he was smart with the name, he was happy to be there, going into it. And I think Joshua did, think it was going to be, and he was asking for pictures with his belt and all that. I think this time, Joshua's mentality might be a little bit different, but I also think Ruiz goes into the fight knowing he can beat him this time, so I do think it's a good rematch.
So talk to me about Saudi Arabia then. I went out there with a recce with the Saulins a few months before, but obviously you've been there to fight. I wasn't there, but talk to me about the whole place, like the logistics. How was it as a setup to box?
The setup to box, the venue was good. It was just a bit of I was at UV Quigg. The atmosphere was unbelievable. I feel me and Grove should have had something similar to British world title fight, and I thought there was an atmosphere. I thought it was going to be silent like the international tournaments, but there was an atmosphere, but it was just they'd cheer when I landed and then the same people would cheer when Groves landed, and it was, so there was noise, but it wasn't passionate, it wasn't, and even the fight we'd build up for that kind of fight should have a big public workout was in like a gym with like a few people there, and it was just, but to be fair, that suited me at the time, because although I understand you've got to do all that stuff, I don't enjoy any of it. I don't enjoy press conferences, public workouts, they're just kind of in the way for me. So I enjoyed that side of it, but looking back, I do feel that fight deserved a better atmosphere.
How do you feel about Groves? Obviously, you won the fight pretty convincingly.
Yeah.
Was there an element of quit in him?
I don't know, because I don't think he quit, although he shook his head on the floor and didn't get up and got up after the thing. So if that's classed as quit, and I don't know. It's a hard one, because obviously a body shot, they're not nice kind of thing. I don't know. I think if I'd have put him down with a headshot and he shook his head, I'd have probably said he quit. But I think a body shot, you kind of give them a little bit of leeway, but he did wait for the 10 and then stood up kind of things. I don't know. I wouldn't want to go around saying he quit, but I think the body shot kind of knocked the fight out of him, to be fair. And I think he knew if he got up. Well, in my mind, cause I didn't know the body shot to put him down. I thought he had just took a knee because of the headshots. And my thing was, you've got to get rid of him before the end of the round. You can't let him, because you just think, if I let him back in this and he comes back and beats me, I'll kick myself. So I just remember thinking, as soon as he gets up, a foot to the floor and get rid of him. And then I seen him shake his head and I thought, he's not getting up. I realised it was probably the body shot.
That's why there's doubt about it, because he was on his knee and he shook
his head. Yeah, he's on his knee shake his head, and that's when I said, well, he's not getting up. Because when I put him down, I didn't think, sometimes when you drop people, you think, that's it, it's done. Whereas I thought he just took a knee to clear his head and then he was going to get up, and then the plan was to go in and just throw everything I could at him, but it was only after I seen the replays and stuff I realised it was the body shot, and I didn't throw the body shot to hurt him, it was more just to bring his arms down and then go back head hunting, because the left hook had started it kind of thing. But I wouldn't, to answer your question, I don't know, it's not nice calling someone a quitter, but I do think he could have got up. I think I would have finished him anyway, but I do think he probably could have got up.
Quitter then.
Yeah.
The shot that actually started it, the left hook, you throw this kind of, it's really unusual, and I've every time I've been in Gallagher's over the years, it's the one shot I've always seen you working on with Joe.
Yeah.
I've seen probably three or four times you catch the right hand with the left, and in the same motion you throw the left hook. But it's a funny one, because I've always thought, how does that work? Because normally you would catch and the rotation of your body takes you through with the opposite hand. But this is, you catch and shoot with the same hand, which over the top of a strong right hand like George has got, that's a very, very difficult shot to land, but one that I know you've been setting up for a long time.
It's weird, I got asked, is it natural or is it practice? And it's both. Like, sometimes I throw and I don't know if through it. It is just a reaction. But it's something I've always worked on. I know it's a good shot and I know it's hard to defend against. If you fight someone who's technically correct and you catch the left hook and throw your own, their right hand should be on the chin, so you're probably going to hit a glove. Whereas if they throw the right and you beat them, by the time they get it back, it's a little bit easy to do. And it's something I've always just found, like, a lot of people probably try and throw it and find it uncomfortable, whereas I find it very comfortable. There's other shots that other fighters control that I found a little bit awkward. But I never thought, Groves mentioned it in a few interviews, and Shane McGuigan mentioned it, he's got a good catch left hook, so I didn't think any right hooks would come, and they never, for like four or five rounds. And then he threw two on the run and I blocked the two of them, and I remember just saying to myself, you've let him hit you with two of them, you've got to counter the next one. And then he fainted and threw it. And I think even if he didn't throw the right hand, I probably just threw the left hook. Anyway, I just anticipated, I knew it was coming, just thought he's starting to get a bit confident with it. I threw it and landed. But that was the first, it was only in that round he started letting the right hook go. I think he was showing a lot of straight to the body, a lot of straight ones to the air, but he wasn't throwing any hook ones.
That was obviously the plan, wasn't it, to start to mix up the levels as the fight went on?
I think obviously, especially with the mentioning, I throw that shot well, you'd probably be silly to come out and throw all the right hooks. So, to be fair to him, he never threw any early, and I say he was throwing a lot of straight ones to the body, which are quite hard to defend against. But the minute he threw a few of them, I knew I've got to counter that. I can't let him keep getting away with it.
Yeah. You had a bit of a tiff with Groves on Twitter, didn't you?
Did I?
Yeah, you did.
I was going to say that. Don't you like him?
No, but it was just a bit of a tiff over and often. I felt like it was on call for. That's why I was digging him out a wee bit there.
I was thinking to clarify for everyone watching, like, why you've been such a dick.
I was thinking that. Well, I'm not being a dick. I don't think I'm being a dick.
No, it was quite funny. I thought it was quite funny. But I just wanted to let everyone know you had a bit of a tiff. I think he's blocked you now, so it's fine.
If you
want to know what he's tweeting, just let me know.
Don't worry about it.
I really mate, real pleasure to have you on the show. I'll obviously see you in Fight Week in a few weeks' time. Yeah. So good luck in the next 4 or 5 weeks of camp. Before you go, though, we're going to do our 32 seconds challenge with 32 Reds. You know the drill. I'm going
to
read you out a list of words.
Just say
the first thing. You can short or long as you like.
Okay,
here we go. So this is the 32 second
nervous
challenge.
Hey, I'm nervous.
Are you nervous? Don't be nervous, mate. It's fine. This is the 32 second challenge with 32 Red with Callum Smith. Liverpool City.
Home.
Echo Arena.
Home.
Your favourite sibling?
Ooh, Holly, little sister.
London Olympics.
Nearly.
Aiba.
Shaft of me.
George Groves.
Good fighter.
Anfield.
Quitter.
Oh, he's going to laugh. I'll get blocked as well now. Anfield.
Hopefully one day.
Fighter you'd most like to fight?
Canelo.
Best person you've sparred?
Tough one. Most profile, probably Carl Froch. Done a lot with him early on.
Yeah. Becoming world champion?
Just the ultimate dream.
And finally, fatherhood?
Special.
Is it,
yeah? It's good, yeah.
Awesome. Good stuff. Callum Smith, absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming on TKO. Great to see you, mate. Good luck on the 23rd of November.
Thank you.
Thank you at home for watching TKO, another episode done and dusted. As always, we'll see you again in 7 days' time.
You've been listening to TKO on Joe, together with 32 Red.